Hello, welcome to episode number 71 of The Big Web Show, the show that's got everything web that matters. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by An Event Apart, the design conference for people who make websites, dedicated to the proposition that the creators of great web experiences deserve a great learning experience. An Event Apart brings together 12 of the leading minds in web design for 3 days of nonstop inspiration and enlightenment. If you care about code as well as content, usability as well as design, An Event Apart is the conference for you. Join us next week in Boston, Massachusetts. Find out more at aneventapart.com. Okay, I'm joined today by Mr. Richard Ziotti, CEO, Chairman, Grand Poobah, and founder of Readability, a platform for readers and writers. Rich, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Jeffrey?
I'm fantastic. What is Readability today? Explain the components of the platform and the idea behind the platform.
Sure. Readability is a web reading platform that manifests itself in a few ways. There is the service, which you just go to readability.com, and you can take advantage of the service through add-ons to your browser, through apps for iOS and Android. Developers and others, publishers, can take advantage of the service through the API, which is a full-featured API that is used quite a bit today. A lot of third parties use the API to power their apps and services and the like. At its core, Readability has a parsing engine that does a really nice job, we hope, most of the time, of finding the content that you want to read and sort of pulling it forward so it becomes nice and comfortable to read. A good way, what I do these days is I just kind of shortcut it by saying, you know that reader button in your iPhone or iPad when you get to an article on mobile Safari? That's Readability. In its most basic form. It actually is Readability. There's some Readability code in there. That's I think that's my 60-second.
who else uses Readability's code? Like, where? What's it in?
It's in iPads and iPhones because the original Readability code was actually taken by Apple, and they did some additional work to it, and so it's the reader button in iOS.
They stole it from you?
I wouldn't use the word stole. They honored us by taking it, and they give us attribution in the bottom of the terms of service somewhere.
So it's open source.
The old version is open source, and that version is in Reader. It's also in it's been ported to just about every programming language. It's in the Kindle hardware, so the article view mode is...
Wow, you just went out. Are you still there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yep.
Okay. Today, the service is really what's taken advantage of. So the service is, hundreds of API keys have been given out. There's a lot of apps out there that are using the Readability engine. Reader, the popular RSS reader, R-E-E-D-E-R, has a great Readability integration. The long form app for iPad is a great reading app for the iPad, uses Readability. Pulse uses Readability. A lot of popular reading apps. We've given out like almost 1,000 API keys at this point. Every day people ask us for keys to play with the platform.
Help people who haven't used Readability understand what it does at its most basic level. What does it do that content on a web page doesn't already do?
At its most basic, it essentially brings forward and normalizes, so to speak, the content so it's consistent. It's really the meat of the page. So typically for articles, it's the headline, the metadata around it.
What am I seeing? I'm hearing about meat, but I'm not. Yeah, what am see, I, as a user, get, what am I seeing?
You get the article. All the stuff around the article pretty much goes away. And people think it's a scraper, but it's really just its goal is inclusive, which is to include the article and make all things leave the room. So navigation and sidebars and related stories and everything else that's not part of the content is left for you to read.
So it's as if you were viewing a page in a print style sheet or in an EPUB style sheet.
That's a good way to look at it, yes.
Or an accessibility view.
That's right, yes.
So you're basically, so if you strip away the navigation and all that other stuff, do people see it first and then you strip it away? How does it work? Or they go to the page and then they click a button on their browser to see readability?
That's right. Again, we're kind of in, if you think about it in two modes, you're sort of in surfing mode where you're hopping around from page to page, and then you peruse a little bit and you say, okay, I want to commit to this and I want to read it. You hit that button and pretty much everything goes away except for the main content.
Although, if I'm using, say, Tweetbot yes. has a readability view where
that's right.
I can either, when I click a link, I can open it on the web page itself, or I could open a readability view of that same content.
That's right.
So oftentimes when I'm on my iPhone, if I'm finding that a lot of the links people are posting are to sites that aren't responsive or don't have a mobile version or something, mm-hmm. Where the mobile context hasn't been taken into consideration, mm-hmm. I can just flip the switch in and then yes. I'll get the readability view for every website, which I think got you in some trouble, right? Because if I can go right to a readability view without seeing the ad and the navigation and all that stuff.
Right.
So one of the first things people complained about who've been critics of the platform was, you're removing my ads. Dude, you're right. Removing my ads.
Right, right. Specifically what that was speaking to was the sharing link around readability. You can share a readability view if you open it. You used to be able to share a readability view if you open it on a mobile device. So we just made that call because it's hard to kind of put a bar above the page. You could open other people's links straight to the mobile view.
Now you can't? It seems like in response to criticism, you step back and change the way it worked, but only on some platforms or in some contexts.
Yeah, there's a lot of cases that we could talk about here. Google has had a mobilizer mode for years.
Sure.
A lot of Twitter clients use it. You can turn it on because it saves a lot of bandwidth, but people use it today. Instapaper, I believe, still has a mobilizer view, which
sure.
If you turn that thing on, pretty much everything you open in a Twitter client will show up in that mobile view.
So why – I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I don't really care. Why is it, would you say, that Google Mobile View hasn't gotten flack and Instapaper hasn't gotten flack, but you have gotten flack for basically doing the same thing? What did you do that's different? What line did you cross that they didn't?
Well, we shared the link was shareable. And if you open that link on mobile, lines and crossing lines is tool to sort of bring into these conversations, because the lines are moving like crazy these days. I'm not sure how constructive a discussion around lines and crossing lines is anymore, because it's very, very easy because there's so many counterexamples and examples to raise around it. So for us at that time, it was that the link was shareable, the mobile link was shareable, but if you use one of the send to services, this is another good example of how the lines don't mean a hell of a lot anymore. Most Twitter clients support us, Instapaper, Pocket, which is another time shift reading app. Mm-hmm. If you push a link to me, if you tweet a link out and I like it and I say send to Pocket or I say send to Readability, and then I go open Readability, I never visit that page. That case applies not just for Readability, it applies pretty much for all of these apps.
You don't visit the original page with the ads and the navigation and all that stuff. You just visit the content.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I could give you theories as to why, you know, we tend to explore more. We probably are more risk takers than others, so maybe that's why we catch a lot of the heat. It's a changing landscape, I guess, is what I'm trying to say on a general level.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny. I mean, going way back in time, you could scrape content. People scraped content, and that was bad. But you could publish your RSS content, and someone else could you know, format it, and that was good. Mm-hmm. There are sites that there are still. Most blogs are good by definition. Bloggers are good, but most bloggers don't write original content or hardly write any of it. They mostly just, you know, and there are blogging communities like Metafilter. Metafilter is great and it's a great community, but they don't publish articles, right? They don't, you know, they're a brilliant community. They're not a brilliant magazine. So a lot of blogging is basically talk, you know, being Roger Ebert, not being, Quentin Tarantino. Right.
Right.
And, it's just, you know, if you were to if you link to someone's article and quote a couple of paragraphs, that's good. Mm-hmm. If you put the whole article on your website, that's bad. Everyone mm-hmm. knows that's bad. Mm-hmm. If you link to someone but use a special link that puts them inside your iframe so that you're also getting traffic or something, that's very bad. So there's all these lines for the stuff we've already done that we kind of all agree on.
Yeah.
But now we're in this realm. Cameron Kozan calls it orbital content, where how I consume content, how I format it is changing, and readability is kind of one of the leading platforms exploring those boundaries, and it seems to really tick some people off.
Mm-hmm.
You have another product recently, which Readlists. Tell us about Readlists. What they do, what's great about them, and why they also tick some people off.
Yeah. Readlists.com. If you go there, if you just start dropping links into Readlists, it's actually built on top of readability. And it processes the page. So if you drop in, you know, three article links, if they're related under some theme or whatnot, and then, those pages can then be bundled up into a book. And you can send that along. So think of it like the college course pack. So I drop five links into a read list. I title the read list, and it could be articles about, you know, foreign policy or the Cold War.
Let's see what's actually there. Today, Film Girl mm-hmm. has created, by which she means curated, which mm-hmm. really means just this is a fancy word for what we're all doing. Mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, Ralph Steadman Art, Mother Earth, Mother Board, Federer as a Religious Experience. These are great magazine articles, things she loves, and she wants to be able to refer to them on her iPad. So she, however she got them, whether they were free on a website or she read them because she uses a subscriber, she packaged them into a book,
mm-hmm.
which she can use herself. And then, and here's where it gets scary for some publishers, she mm-hmm. can share that book.
Yes.
People, so I publish a list apart, which is basically a labor of love, but we do pay people on staff, and we are supported by advertising.
Mm-hmm.
One ad, one deck ad per page.
Yeah.
And yeah, anyone who loves a list apart could go to that magazine, pick their 10 favorite articles, pick their 100 favorite articles, and make a book out of it. That doesn't worry me. It doesn't bother me a bit. Some publishers are worried about this, but to me, I think it would be very cool if mm-hmm. someone's finding another use for our content, repackaging it like that.
Mm-hmm.
If they're selling it, that's uncool. Do you have – are there safeguards in place that would keep someone from making a read list books? Say some unscrupulous person goes to my site, scrapes 100 articles, and then calls it a web design book that they've published. What prevents that kind of stuff from happening?
Nothing.
Okay, so that's why you're getting...
Yeah,
has anyone done it?
No. It's interesting. So you're bringing up good points here. I mean, why would you create a tool that is potentially, you know, could potentially cause harm? That's really what you're asking, right?
I guess. I mean, I have apps that let me burn disks I own.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't, I suppose it could potentially cause harm because you might not own the content. Or you could distribute it without the author's permission.
Yeah, and here's where this all gets kind of tricky, right? When you start to talk about things like owning the content, and you cast that in the light of Tumblr, which is effectively a really powerful recycling engine. Yeah. That's how I see Tumblr.
I see it as the human centipede.
Yeah.
Of blogging.
And so ownership, and you know, it goes on and on, right? I mean, it runs the gamut. Like Pinterest, Pinterest, obviously, you know, they took some flack and have put some mechanisms in place for attribution and things like that.
YouTube.
Anyway, exactly.
If a real copyright lawyer looks at any of this stuff, they would shut it right down.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems to me that something's happening on the internet, right? And
that's right.
You could say, well, this is all piracy, and then close your mind and be done. Mm-hmm. Or you can say, something interesting is emerging. What's happening? What are people doing with this stuff anyway in this kind of folksy way? It seems like...
And to take that, to sort of complete that thought, I think the thing that's worth asking also is, you know, what opportunities lie, what sort of value can be derived from these sorts of enabling tools that are out there and we could tell you very, very directly, 99% of people love, right? So you have an audience out there that is loving these tools. We probably got 10,000 pings on ReadList, 9,950 of them, 9,920 of them were just, this is awesome. I'm going to use this for school. I'm going to use this to do this or that. And there was, you know, obviously others who were detractors who said, okay, this is damaging. This is going to cause harm. I guess what we're trying to put forward here is that, you know, the landscape's changed. Opportunities are arising out of it. And you can sort of hunker down and say, well, I'm going to protect the fort, right? Meanwhile, the web is the web. And the tools like Pinterest, like Tumblr, like ReadLists, like other, you know, sort of enabling and empowering tools are pretty terrifying to people who create content and own it.
So it's enabling and empowering to some and threatening to others.
Yeah, and I guess what we'd put forward is, what can we do with platforms like this, these powerful platforms like this? That we by no means don't have sort of a secret dossier that has the exact answer of how this flips everything on its head and turns it all into, you know, success for everyone. But we think it's important to start exploring things like this, because the question that gets raised is the defensive, you know, you start to question the defensibility of saying, well, I'm going to go fight this war. Meanwhile, the web is swallowing everything whole.
And we've seen that in the music business. We're seeing it in magazine publishing.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I see you as an R&D guy, not like a creative artist, but an R&D. I see your lab, right, Arc 90 Labs, as R&D. And R&D is amoral by nature. It's basically what can we make? What happens if we do this?
Yep.
But before Steve Jobs came back to Apple and made it very consumer-facing and successful again, it was completely an R&D company, and people were making all kinds of cool stuff that they didn't actually have any business model for, but they just wanted to see if they could do it. And,
right.
You know, Apple was they had component-level apps that you basically didn't need applications. They were just like these mechanisms built into the operating system.
Yes.
Things you could combine. It was very empowering for the user. But as opposed to the fascist Apple of today with its Apple Store, you know, it wasn't profitable for Apple. It was completely empowering any consumer who wanted to learn a little bit about being a programmer.
Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing, and you know, if you sort of look at this on a continuum, because there isn't one event that sort of causes this change, right? What was viewed as very controversial a year ago, a year and a half ago, just this week, Apple announces that you can sync your offline content, your read list, your reading list, in iCloud, right? So
of course.
So it's gone mainstream. Just, you know, in a way.
iCloud, they did that with the music. It's just the same thing. At one time, they fingerprinted every, you know, I had tunes that I bought from the iTunes store that, you know, like, I couldn't give to my, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't give to my then wife.
Yep.
Right, for her to play. She'd have to buy her own copy and, you know, all this nonsense and you know.
That's right. That's right. And we're excited to see that happen. We think it's awesome that it is hitting mainstream, because that is sort of the beginning of real change. You know, I was talking to a friend this morning, and, you know, the analogy he gave was punk rock, right? You know,
that's the analogy we always give for everything, but yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's kids are going to commit suicide, and it's really scary, and if you play it backwards, the devil talks to you.
That was death metal, actually. That was heavy metal, but okay.
All right, exactly. I mean, but then what happens 20 years later, you know, the guy who's into punk rock is...
They're selling Plymouths with it.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, for us, we're excited to just be part of that timeline, and we're excited to see it materialize in a WWDC as something official that is now viewed as mainstream, because...
And you helped push it along. You're part of the historical process that helped push that along. I made that point. I get that. I can also see, you know, why some people might disagree vehemently and dislike it, but I want to move on to something else. Yep. You said a few moments ago that you have a lot of supporters, that 99% of the people who use read lists or readability, you know, the iPad app, that they love these things. Mm-hmm. My question is, where are they? Where are all those people who love it when you're under attack? Because what I've noticed, mm-hmm. when... maybe 10 very vocal critics, you'll post something, 10 very vocal critics will castigate you. I really don't see, I mean, I'll jump in.
Yeah.
I'm not scared. My credibility's shot anyway, but I don't see your fans rushing to your aid. And I'm puzzled by that. Today, you made an announcement. People can see it if they go to blog.readability.com.
Mm-hmm.
I guess first, talk to me about, well, actually, let's back it up just a second. One of the things that you wanted to do with readability was provide another model for publishers to get paid, right?
That's right.
So you had this experiment where people, customers paid $5 a month or more,
mm-hmm.
and readability parceled that money out among the websites they read.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea was a publisher would register with you, they'd get their check automatically, and, you know, it might that if this caught on, this new mm-hmm. method of paying publishers, it's not the paywall subscription model that exists now. It's not advertising. It's this third thing. If it caught on, it might be a way for small publishers to scrape by and get more income than they have now. And it might be a way for big publishers to perhaps not jam their website with ad after ad after ad that their layouts train their users to ignore. Right? Because we're on this vicious cycle right now where people ignore ads, so we put more ads, make them more spectacular, charge more. Then more people just learn, okay, that's an ad, I'll ignore that. Right?
Right? Right.
I think you were trying to... I sat in the room with you guys while you were figuring this stuff out, or some of the time when you were figuring this stuff out, and I know that you love writers, and we're trying to figure out how to get writers and publishers paid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what you wanted to do.
Yes.
So you set up this system...
Yep.
And today at blog.readability.com, you made this announcement that's basically said you're stopping it and giving the money to charity. What happened?
Okay. So this was unconventional, right? This was a model that was pretty much didn't have much precedent, in that what we'd proposed was, when you paid us fees, a certain amount of those fees would be we would essentially take a chunk of it, put it aside, watch your traffic activity through readability, and then apportion the fees based on how the traffic flowed. So if 20% of your traffic was to site X registers with us, they get that money in aggregate from all the users of readability. We learned a couple things when this went live. One was, hundreds of thousands of sites have flowed through the platform. Actually, probably millions of domains, but a lot of anonymous usage exists on readability.
What does that mean? Back up, explain that.
Well, you can pretty much get the add-on right now, not sign up and have an account, and just use the
read-all feature. Right. So people who are using the old plugin.
Correct.
It's also filtered through readability, but you can't give anybody money for that.
That's right. Because we don't know. Yeah, exactly.
You don't know who the people are. They're not paying. Whatever.
That's right. So what happened was we have this separate account, and we were putting money aside and watching what was happening in terms of activity. And we learned a couple things. First, we learned that the use was incredibly fragmented. It wasn't as if a typical user was visiting 18, 20 sites a day and their money was nicely getting diced up amongst those sites. It just wasn't the case. It was hundreds of sites and an incredible long tail of distributing that money. So pennies were getting distributed across many sites. The other thing we found was the great majority of publishers didn't sign up. Here's the thing.
Why?
We can't, how do you get hundreds of thousands of sites? I mean, we don't have a multi-million dollar campaign to tell everybody, please come sign up and support readability and support this model. We put the word out there, and we do have to confirm. I mean, this is another thing that people kind of gloss over, is that you can't just fill a form out and say, I own the New York Times. We had to confirm who you are, right? Otherwise, people will steal money. So you had to drop a key onto your site. We confirm that it's there. It's all almost like setting up.
The same
up
way Google works and Google Maps, and the same way Typekit works. Everybody,
exactly.
You put
exactly
this little thing on your site that verifies who you are, and then you can, it's like a little handshake.
Mm-hmm. So fast forward 12 months, we've issued to date two, or about to do our third issuance of funds. And when we run those stats, we realize that north of 90% of the money was never going to be claimed.
Because there are little $40 here, $12 there.
Well, some are actually big numbers, just the publishers won't come and register.
How hard did you try to reach out to these publishers?
Here's where it gets ugly, right? This is where it gets really tricky. If I reach out to publisher A, B, and C, right? Like, I make a concerted effort to find who the right person is to talk to.
They haven't come to you, so you go to who is.
Exactly. Or whatever. So I try some attempt. First off, it's many, many thousands, right? It's hundreds of thousands, number one. Number two, if I do it for A, B, and C, and I don't do it for D, E, and F, you could make an argument that we've essentially favored or paid attention to or made more of a proper effort for A, B, and C and not for D, E, and F.
Got
right?
It. Right.
So it's tricky, right?
You level the playing field by saying, here we are, we've got money for you, you didn't even ask for, please just sign up for our service and then we'll be happy to pay you. That's to level the playing field. You made the same offer to everyone.
Exactly. And I did go. We do have relationships with some very big publishers. They know of us. They know we exist. And we can get into sort of the internal decision making around whether they take the leap or not. But many of them know we're around. They like what we're doing. And they just won't sign up because, I don't know, there's teams of lawyers who don't want to deal or whatever the reason may be.
The New York Times, for example.
The New York Times is our number one site. And
they know about you and they like you.
Well, I've visited their offices and told them, you should probably sign up. And they don't sign up.
Because we've got all this money for you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And
is there a legal problem? Would they be?
No,
would
I don't
it be
think
prostitution? I mean,
I don't,
what
I
are
don't,
what are they worried about?
I just think it's alien. I just think they just, there's a particular way things work today. And then all of a sudden we show up and we're kind of, it's a little off the wall and they just don't know what to make of it. And they probably don't want to deal to a large extent.
Was there something wrong with your contract that they couldn't sign? Did they tell you we looked at your contract?
They even read it. What? I doubt they even read it. We would obviously somebody as important as the New York Times, we would have been glad to have a dialogue with them. Hey, but here's, I think, the broader issue, Jeffrey.
You used to be a lawyer, right? Or you went to law school. You went to law school. Did you write the contract yourself?
With some outside counsel.
Do you think, in hindsight, that might have been a mistake?
No, I don't think that was what... My understanding of why the great majority of publishers didn't sign up to readability is because the great majority of publishers don't know readability exists.
Okay.
We're not Facebook. We're not...
Sure.
Invasive.
But when you're in the offices of the New York Times and you say, you guys made $50,000 this month or whatever it is, and we'd really like... I mean, Spy Magazine did a thing 15, 20 years ago where they sent the smallest possible checks they could to wealthy people just to see whether they would cash them. And they sent like a 12-cent check to... It was like $0.12. They sent that to... what's his name with the wig? You know, the Trump, the guy with the erections all over town.
Is that a wig?
Whatever that is.
Okay.
Whatever that is.
Okay.
The guy who builds the giant gold erections and writes his name on them.
Right.
They sent him 12 cents and he cashed it. I mean, it was probably his secretary. But so the point is, even really rich people, if you give them free money, they'll take it.
Yeah, well, we weren't cutting checks, to be clear. What we were doing was saying we need to confirm you are who you... Think about how it trickles through a big organization just to get to the guy who's going to drop the code on the page to confirm that it's the right site. Think about like how that even trickles down.
These aren't mostly big corporate sites, are they? Aren't they mostly like, you know, Sally's blog?
Yeah, they are. I mean, but again, I think Sally's blog just has to find out about readability and do it and sign up and do it.
I would think like mommy bloggers. There's really active categories of bloggers that would just jump on this. Like that are struggling. To me, there's lots of people that are, you know, you write a great mommy blog and maybe you're getting a few $100 in advertising revenues a month, but it's not enough. It's not enough. It's something like this, it could be great.
Yeah. And again, you know, you could say, well, what's success? I mean, we've had over, you know, almost 2,500 public, you know, domain owners actually did sign up. We've even had what we consider as success stories, because what we really needed to happen, Jeffrey, was for the publishers to not just sign up and passively hope this thing works. What we needed them to do is get behind it.
You needed evangelists.
You needed people to say, okay, users, readers love these tools. Otherwise, why do they exist and why are they successful? And we want to get behind usage patterns and behaviors that our readers love, right? So the New York Review of Books is a great counterexample to this whole story. They, from the early days, put the buttons on the site, put the read now and read later buttons on every page on their site. And that's a great story for a couple of reasons. One is they learned something. They learned that it didn't cannibalize the site, that fear wasn't founded. And the second thing was that, you know, they were getting a disproportionate amount of the fees because they were driving their own readers back to the service, right? So that was a great story, and they bought into it and they took a risk there that, you know, proved positive. Now,
in fact, if you send, I did that too. I mean, before my redesign, I had readability buttons on everything, and to me. Mm-hmm. Not that I thought about it in a mercantile way. I really don't care. I really was more interested in the experiment, even though people don't. I was never going to make that much money from this. It wasn't a thing that was going to tempt me. Like, I'm human and fallible and venal and disgusting like everyone else. But there's got to be like a lot of money involved for me to be sleazy. I'm not going to be sleazy over $40 a month, right? So, but I put the buttons there. I mean, it just makes sense. They've already seen your ad. Mm-hmm. Now they click the readability view. I mean, to me, one of the problems, and I used to use you, I still do. There's a talk I give where I sort of carrot and stick, and I use readability as a threat. I say, if we don't design content so that people can actually read it and enjoy it, if we make content hard to find, we devote 10% of the page to content and the rest filled with crap. Of course, that's, you know, and it's coming partly from mobile. Where you have to focus on the content, but it's also coming from guys like you and Instapaper. It's like then Instapaper and readability are just going to come take all our readers, and you're going to be out of a job, Mr. Designer. If you want to keep designing content sites, you better figure out how to make that content findable, attractive, not just legible, but a joy to read,
accessible.
Otherwise, a third party app will do it for you.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So, I both loved readability, but also viewed it as a threat. I had this, I don't know if I'm explaining this well, but I basically, you're like a carrot and a stick, both, right? You're like a wonderful mm-hmm. thing for readers, and at the same time, you're what's going to happen to designers if they don't get with the program and basically make you obsolete. Of course, by then you'll have thought of something else that readability can do, and you'll never be obsolete. But the primary value of readability right now, you know, an Instapaper to me is time shifting and declutterizing. And time shifting will always be there, but if designers get better at doing their jobs, then they won't need your app to declutter the page.
Well, I think there's a bigger challenge than that. I mean, I think it's a good thing. We see sort of the influence of tools like this on design as people sort of, you know,
yeah, no kidding,
double down on the single column, the larger type, and make it just more comfortable. And we think that's great.
Yeah, me and about five other people wouldn't have redesigned our sites the mm-hmm. way we did if not yeah. for readability. I mean, it's very direct cause and effect.
Yeah, and we think that's great, but we think there's still an elephant in the room. I mean, there's still a big problem, which is even if you sort of approach it that way and say, okay, we're going to make this attractive enough, you know, what are the models that are working today? Right. I think this is the big, going back to your question of, you know, why did we get singled out? And I do think
there's no question. Yeah, you guys are the bad guys, and mm-hmm. other people who do the same thing are the good guys. Not sure why.
I think here's one of the reasons I think we get singled out, and that's that we didn't think about this in the context of I could build a disruptive business that's going to rise out of the ashes of what I'm going to decimate. Or I'm going to build a profitable business that's going to be on a smaller scale and just, you know, be more of a lifestyle business that I get to enjoy the profits from and lay low and not really rock the boat. What we tried to do was we actually tried to engage the problem. And right. that's a big, scary thing to do, right? And it's a problem that's much bigger than just us. We think that it's going to take this kind of creative thinking to start to really attack a bigger challenge than readability making your stuff not look so great. Because the bigger challenge is that web ads are struggling. And web ads, we've programmed readers to ignore them, to blur them out. And we need to play around and find new ways and new mechanisms that are going to support the stuff we love to read, the stuff we want to support the creators of this of that content.
And okay, but you know what? For whatever reason, there is a group of people that absolutely don't believe you. They absolutely don't believe you. I saw a thing today that said it's in the comments on your blog.readability.com. If you go to the comments on your article today, there's like readability, the most egregiously unethical startup in internet history. That's saying something, man. Internet history, 20 years, right? There's some picture of you in your lunchroom looking cross-eyed. And it says like steal content, make money. It's amazing. I feel bad. I know you guys. I know how nice you are.
Yeah,
and it's just like it's shocking to me.
Well, let me just publicly say that we love everybody on the internet.
Okay. What's the thing Paul Ford says?
What
did Paul Ford say about the internet? He said this great thing. Come on, you can quote Paul Ford.
Why wasn't I consulted? That whole thing, or
no. Okay, no. Oh, maybe we can't say it on this.
We can't say it on this show.
Okay, no. Never mind. It appears that Zeldman has gone into full wag the dog mode, says Amanda Mask.
I don't know what that means.
I don't. Wag the Dog was a nice movie. They said that during the Monica Lewinsky affair, then when America was attacked and Clinton defended the country, people said he was actually defending the country to get people's minds off the Monica Lewinsky affair. And there were many who suggested that he'd he'd orchestrated the attack so he could, you know, get our minds off his sex life, which...
Okay.
So Wag the Dog is where you...
Yeah, I got it.
Unscrupulously invert reality and, mm-hmm. yeah. Here's what I want to know. Like, every time you guys get attacked, I'll go to your defense, even... Unless you've actually done something wrong, in my estimation, which
I'd like you to call us out.
And I see
exactly. I mean, Tim Murtaugh, I don't want.
There's a couple of people here like defending you, but where I understand that there are people here, you could literally crucify your own foreskin and it wouldn't satisfy these people, right? I think if you cut your own hands off and said, "I am a guilty, horrible man, and we've done a terrible thing." And I'm going to put myself in hell for 100 years. They would still be angry. I mean, no matter what you do, there's
a lot of emotion there. Yeah,
I don't. Maybe I'm just being tone deaf. I don't get how like giving to charity is a bad thing.
You know, it was a tricky story. I mean, let me try to be sympathetic for a second here.
Do you think you made a terrible mistake? Should you have just given everyone their money back? Could you? You certainly could give everybody their money back, couldn't you?
Well, we can't because we've given publishers money.
Oh, okay.
In fact, we plan on giving every single publisher that's registered with us their money. We encourage people to register. They have some time to do so. But anyone that's registered prior are going to get their money, no matter how small the amount. That's worth clarifying. So
you couldn't fully refund.
A 16-cent check with a 45-cent stamp. How much are stamps?
So if you had decided to refund everyone's money, it would be that portion of money that didn't go out to publishers and that didn't cover the cost of contacting the publisher and sending them the money.
Right.
Okay.
And again, you know, what this was, you know, when we found ourselves in a place where, you know, the long tail was crazy and not enough publishers were showing up, and publishers can still show up, by the way. It's worth saying that if you're a domain owner, you can go to readability.com and register your site.
What's the process?
You sign up. It's a short form, and then we give you a code, a key, and you have to drop that on your site, and then we look for it. And if we confirm, okay, you obviously own this site. And then from there, you just fill out the rest of your information. We cut you a check.
Did Daring Fireball join?
I don't know. I don't know if Daring Fireball joined.
John Gruber from Daring Fireball called you and everyone connected with Readability, which includes me, scumbags. Has he revised his opinion? Did you ever reach out to him? And did you guys work that out?
I don't know how you worked something like that out. We invited him over for lunch. I think you know what was.
Yeah, but then you served the wrong sandwich. I heard about that.
You know, for us, people sort of filled in the blanks. And I think it was a challenging story to tell, and people went ahead and filled in the blanks. So we were framed as a bait and switch. We were framed as people who were taking money, stuffing our pockets with it under the banner of saying it's for publishers. For people to, you know, when you kind of go there, I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, he's an intelligent guy, obviously, and very well respected. I don't know why it went there. Maybe he was just doing his job, which is to just, you know, write exciting stuff in small paragraphs again and again. I don't know. It's too bad. I don't know how someone just leaps to that conclusion and just decides that we're scumbags. Can you say scumbags? Is this still PG? I was going to say used.
I think scumbags is okay.
Used contraception was the placeholder phrase I was going to use.
I don't think anyone thought about the literal meaning of that until just now.
Okay.
So thank you so much.
That's just too bad.
I broke the ice. I mean, I said foreskin, so.
You did. That's
which,
true.
I mean, you're Lebanese Christian, right?
I am.
So
I
therefore. Am.
That wow.
Okay, never mind. I don't know.
See, the charities, you know, the nonprofits just emailed me saying we don't want the money anymore after what Zelman just brought up.
I'm sorry. What have you done right? Let's get out of the defensive crouch. Mm-hmm. What are you proud of, and where is Readability going?
That's a great question. What have we done right? We view readability as a platform, and we say that over and over again. But we, you know, Readless sort of punctuates that vision of it being a platform. And when you build a platform, and you know, when you look at our traffic, we're 85% of our traffic, or if not north of that, is through the API, and that we're powering all these apps out there and powering these new experiences out there, and building tools like read lists, which are just sort of, you know, you have to do a double take and say, whoa, this is different. We think we're R&D, as you said, and you know, how do you explore new ways to find value in that content? In content that's out there, I think you have to experiment and you have to explore. And we're excited that we're part of the narrative that is still playing out, that still hasn't fit. We're excited that in 2009, this thing came out as a bookmarklet. And in 2011, it was in every iPhone and iPad. And now they've essentially created the same functionality on every Apple device. And we'll probably see that happen from their competitors and so on. So we want to continue to do that. And
I think you should be proud of the effect you're having on design too. I think mm-hmm. I think you guys and Instapaper, right? And I think all of you guys mm-hmm. with the focus on content, you guys and then mobile are the two forces that are, I think, forcing designers to confront a lot of their own biases mm-hmm. I mean, I remember being so angry in the 90s when mm-hmm. good web design meant 9-point Arial in 8 lines of 9-point Arial in a little scroll box with a scroller that replicated the scrolling function of the browser mm-hmm. only in Flash, only it was did it upside down and backwards and sucked mm-hmm. and I remember like having to judge design award shows where like everything looked like that and everything was like a gigantic screen full of diagonal lines and stuff popping up all over your face.
Yep.
horrible stuff.
I agree, and I think that positive direction, I think, is a good direction to take things in. I think it's gotten bad. I think you can have a great experience on the web. You don't need it to be an iPad app to have a great experience. And I think to be able to sort of influence that thinking is great as well. Yeah, I mean we're really glad to see that happen. And also just from an accessibility perspective, making that content, allowing it to come forward is a really powerful thing. You know, there we get emails all the time from the elderly, from educators who, help kids with cognitive difficulties. And they tell us that, this tool is really valuable because the web is so noisy and it doesn't need to be like that. So
are you afraid that someone like Amazon is going to come along in 2 years, do the exact same thing you tried to do, and succeed where you failed because they're Amazon and they can throw $1 million at it and everyone knows who they are and they have a built-in trust relationship with a grudging trust relationship with publishers, right? Because publishers hate and fear them too. But
right, yeah, no, no, I don't fear it. I think We're small and nimble, and we like to innovate. And whatever they do a year from now, we'll have done something dramatically different already.
I'm sure you will. This is great.
And you got to keep moving. I mean, that's one thing we know for sure. And that's to sort of punctuate what's ahead. A lot of people have said, okay, well, is this the end of readability? It's by no means. We're doubling down, and we've got some really exciting things we're doing as we look ahead. So we're actually excited about the next phase.
Here's an interesting question from the hashtag AskReadability that we posted for today's podcast. So the curator, it's got a Spinal Tap thingy. It says, when will you enable curators to get paid?
Wow.
I think never since you can't publish, since you can't pay writers, I don't think paying, but still.
Yeah. Like one goal at a time, right?
Okay. Someone else, Brian Wee asked, how do you plan to make money? It's a good one.
you know, how do you, if I could tweak that question, you see, how do you plan to, you know, create value such that, you know, we're in an ecosystem where the consumers of stuff and the creators of stuff and the curators of stuff are benefiting from it, we think we'll be in a good place. I know that sounds completely vague, but that's a tricky question because it's going to be something different than who knew, you know, let's zoom, you know, go back 15 years and say, well, advertising dollars are going to shift dramatically to a search box. Like,
right.
Who the hell knew that was going to go down?
Google, not even Google knew.
Not even Google knew, right?
So, again, they were R&D. They were amoral R&D. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of smart people making a better search. They said, wow, search really isn't very good. Yep. And this, you know, Yahoo, these hierarchical search arrangements, that there's no sustainability in that.
Exactly.
And they're very lucky. And probably they hired the right CEO who said, wow, we could actually make money with this. So here's Brian. These are all variations of the same question. Johan E. Johansson, right? I hope I said that right. Will your new biz model be for your profit only, or will there be new ways for writers to monetize as well? Kind of a little snarky, but fair.
That's a good question. It could be. I think it could be. You know, we look for analogies in other models, and as we think about what's going to work, will people pay for content? Will people pay for, you know, the book's been shattered, so there's this sort of in-between that people seem to be paying for with Kindle singles and longer right. form content. Are there opportunities to sort of, bring new options in front of people? I think, you know, what's tricky about this?
Yeah. What? Could you be a tool for actual publishers? Like, if I wanted to, so ReadList already exists. It wouldn't be that much harder to give publishers custom options so that I could make, if I wanted to make a best of a list apart book that people could have on their Kindles or their iPads that would just my favorite or our staff's favorite 30 articles from the past 18 years or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That we could do that and brand it and either sell it if we chose to or give it away free. But
I think those kinds of possibilities are really really interesting. And we want to, again, it's more R&D. It's more exploration.
Are you afraid that? So it seems to me that the people who really dislike you guys, if you boil it down, their fundamental issue. And again, I think you could level the same accusation against Metafilter if you chose to. I wouldn't put it against them either. I think this is the fundamental complaint, as I understand it, is if you didn't make the content, you shouldn't make money off it. It's not fair. Now that's what publishers do, right? This is what Amazon does. They make money off content they didn't create, but they're providing a distribution model and the publisher opts in or doesn't. Is there a danger to the very idea of readability ever making a profit in that if you find a way to make a profit, you will by definition be ticking off those who dislike you? And should you therefore run at a loss forever? And then they'll be okay with the existence of your product and be glad that you make a product that makes it easier to read web pages.
I think the phrase make money off the content, if you apply that literally to the iTunes top 10 news category for paid apps, you'd have to get rid of 5 of them. We are building tools and capabilities and lenses into existing content. So there are people who are making more money off the content than we are.
To me, it's the same as an RSS reader. To me, it's the same as Instapaper. Instapaper doesn't charge by the month. It charges for the download of the product. Your product is free, and you had a way of monetizing money for publishers where you took a cut, and now you're getting rid of that. So you may just continue to be a free product. But do you think that – I don't know. Do you think that there's a stink on you in some circles that you'll never be able to get off?
No, I don't. We've gone to great lengths to let people and let publishers and let writers know what we're trying to do. And by doing that, and it's actually been really helpful to just be in the middle of New York City and go out there and talk to people and really lay bare and be transparent about what we're trying to do. I think there are some really exciting things ahead. Because I think the bigger question isn't about what can readability pull this off. The bigger question is what's going to be next for publishing and for writers and for content creators out there that's going to give them viable opportunity.
Hear, hear. I like that. I agree with you. We have one last question before we go. It's from a gentleman named Aaron Lammer. It's in the Ask Readability with hashtag, and it says, why did you schedule the show against Netherlands versus Germany?
I know Aaron. He's a soccer fan. You can answer that one, Jeffrey. I don't need to.
I'm a legendary sports fan, so
okay.
I really can't.
And it is taped, right? So he can check this
okay.
out.
Matthew D. Heavy. I thought we addressed this one last one. Sorry. We're going over, but I don't really care. Matthew D. At Heavy says would have liked to hear why they didn't just return the money to subscribers. I thought we talked about that a bit, but if you could just give a very clear answer, mm-hmm. why didn't you just return the money to subscribers?
Well, we put forward a particular model, and we do have 2,000 plus publishers, domain owners who signed into the model, registered with us,
and they're getting paid.
And they're going to get paid, right?
Right. So you can't return the money because you're paying publishers,
right?
I hope that. Well, you know what? We can always have you on the show again, or you can always write another yep. blog post and get more yep. of Joe Clark's comments.
Yeah, yeah. 6 months from now, we'll put something else out. We'll get yelled at a whole lot, and we'll do this again. I'm looking forward to it.
Meantime, keep experimenting.
I will.
Keep the flame alive.
Okay. You got some editing to do, Jeffrey. There's some bad words in there.
There was one.
Okay. Yeah,
take
true.
Care.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye. Take care.